Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. On today's show, I am joined by Daniel Mabee, Asia President of the United Natural Products Alliance. Daniel shares his expert insights into the rapidly growing nutraceutical industry within the Asia-Pacific region, focusing on current market trends, the importance of third-party certification, and the evolving dynamics of dietary supplements influenced by an aging population, rising health consciousness, and digital platforms. Daniel begins by discussing the role and upcoming events of the UNPA, setting the stage for a deep dive into how demographic shifts, consumer health consciousness, and digital platforms are shaping the demand for dietary supplements in APAC. He explains the critical role of third-party certification in building consumer trust and facilitating market entry for new brands. The conversation covers the specific market characteristics of China, Japan, and South Korea, highlighting how each country's unique regulatory and consumer environment affects the strategy for dietary supplement brands. Daniel also touches on the burgeoning opportunities in Southeast Asian markets like Vietnam, Thailand, and Indonesia. Further, he emphasizes the significance of e-commerce and digital sales channels in these regions, offering strategic advice for U.S. brands aiming to penetrate these markets effectively. Enjoy.
You know, if you look at the way in which global trade is now developing, I'll give China as an example. So China, back in 2022, the General Administration for China Customs, they announced what is called Decree 248. For imported food producers. So this requires companies, whether it's in Canada, the US, other markets, to go on to a China Customs portal called the National Single Window. Every country actually has one of these National Single Windows. And you have to disclose information about your product, about the production of it, so that there's more assurance that these products that are coming into, say, China or Japan or South Korea, they're already in compliance with their competent authorities. So the competent authorities, say, in the US would be the FDA. And how to verify that is going to become more and more serious.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Daniel, welcome to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you, Todd. Great to be here.
Where in the world are you that we're recording you from today?
I am in Salt Lake City, Utah, but I actually just recently relocated back from China. I had lived in China for about 13 years on and off, both study abroad and working in China. So it's a little bit of culture shock being back in the States. And I spent all of COVID in China as well. But it's good, actually. I'm glad I moved back. There's a lot of really critical work to be done on supply chains and other issues in this industry. So yeah, Salt Lake City, Utah is the place to be right now.
What city or cities did you live in China?
I lived in Beijing most of the time. I did study abroad in Harbin, up in Heilongjiang province for a semester, which was very interesting, actually. If you don't know, that used to be on the kind of Trans-Siberian Railway. They brought all the latest European fashions in like the 1920s on the railway, went through Harbin down to Shanghai. So Harbin back then actually was really kind of the cosmopolitan city, even more cosmopolitan than Shanghai in some ways, because all the latest fashions first got to Harbin.
I've been there. I actually got engaged to my wife on New Year's Eve 2008-2009 in Harbin.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow.
And it was
on the central street, or where did you get engaged?
No, we were at a gala in a hotel. Okay. And it was a big conference room, and there was like 300-400 people in there, all for this New Year's Eve gala and buffet and the whole nine yards. And it was kind of the stroke of midnight type of thing. And then I did it then, but I just remember it was cold. I think I carried a flask of whiskey with me everywhere we went, trying to stay warm. And we went to the amazing zoo up there to see the tigers and the lions and the ligers and all that kind of stuff. And then they had this amazing ice, amusement park almost. It was everything was made out of ice. An entire Starbucks coffee shop was all completely made out of ice. You know, when it's that cold, you get creative on tourist attractions.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah. So now, before we dive into the discussion on nutraceutical trends in APAC, give us a brief intro to the UNPA, and then maybe give us the quick pitch about the event that you're helping organize in mid-October with WPIC.
Sure. So UNPA is the United Natural Products Alliance. It's an industry alliance that was founded in 1992. This is back when the nutraceutical, natural health product, dietary supplement industry, whatever you want to call it, actually under the federal statute, it's dietary supplements. It back then is about a $6 billion industry. So we've seen this industry go from 1992, $6 billion to today in 2024 to a $68 billion industry. And we've worked very closely with the legislators to work to build a compliance model for dietary supplements. That was really the framework built by the president and founder of UNPA, Lauren Israelson, called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994. And really the rest is history. I mean, this industry is really growing incredibly. It's a global industry with a global supply chain, with a global export market. And that then really feeds into the October event that you just mentioned that we will be hosting with WPIC and the U.S. Commercial Service and International Trade Administration. It's on October 16th. And this is a broader effort together with WPIC to accelerate entry into APAC countries and exports to these markets while ensuring compliance with both U.S. regulations and the regulations of those countries. So if you're available for that event, it will be a great event, and feel free to sign up for it.
Absolutely. While we're here and talking about it, how would people go find out more, and where would they go to sign up?
You have to register with the U.S. Commercial Service. So I'm sure WPIC right now is promoting it and sending out that a registration link to their clients and contacts. We are doing the same, and U.S. Commercial Service is also doing the same. And by the way, UNPA has a formal partnership with the U.S. Commerce Department through what's called a Market Development Cooperative Grant. So this is really kind of a multi-year effort to build these export markets.
Okay. So I know at least one of those URLs is WPIC.co. So you can head over there to get more information if you don't find it anywhere else. So we're going to start with introduction to market trends. And I'm going to ask you to maybe discuss the trends in the Asia Pacific region that are driving the increased demand for dietary supplements, especially in the context of health, beauty, and wellness.
Sure. So I think, first of all, taking a step back and looking at the global industry is helpful. So the global industry, as defined as dietary supplements, is about $170 billion. As I mentioned, the U.S. market is about $68 billion. And so if you start looking at APAC, China is about 14% of that, Japan, 6%. The rest of Asia, actually quite small, at around 2% of the global industry. But if you throw in India as well, which is about 7% of the industry, Asia, in the kind of broader context, represents about 30% of the global industry, and they are a major supplier of ingredients because they also have traditional medicinal practices that are very related to dietary supplements. So you have traditional Chinese medicine in China. I'm most familiar with TCM, as it's known in China, since I've lived there, but Japan, South Korea, a lot of these other markets also have medicinal histories and practices that really kind of blend in well, I think, with the modern dietary supplement industry. And we can learn a lot from them. They can also learn from us. And so I think as you see now with the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, more consumers are much more focused on immune support and preventive healthcare. But at the same time, some of these APAC markets like Japan and South Korea, they have aging populations. So they're going to really be looking to age-related health conditions, bone health, cognitive function. Also, I think probably most interesting is functional supplements for professional workers. As we all know, APAC countries, whether it's Japan, South Korea, China, and many others that I'm probably less familiar with, have very, very hardworking populations, demanding hours, demanding commutes to work. And so having kind of more functional supplements for cognitive functions, for performance, is also, I think, a key part of these new market trends. And then lastly, I really do believe that, you know, we are living in the age of trying to extend the lifespan of humans. If you look, you know, on YouTube, you have Brian Johnson and Andrew Huberman talking about these topics fairly often. And these social media, not that they're social media influencers, they're actually Andrew Huberman's a Stanford scientist, but their media now is reaching consumers in some of these markets, being translated with subtitles so that people are really getting the latest scientific information on supplementing. And so I think that's also a big part of this is the education piece going on.
Yeah. Shout out to the Huberman podcast. What is it called? It's the Huberman experiment or the Huberman something, but it's brilliant.
Yeah, it is brilliant. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I don't know if you've heard about Brian Johnson. He's actually a Utah native. So he has really opened up all the data on his supplementation and blood work and just opened it basically like an open source project to see how useful or how functional supplementing is or fasting, other types of you know, health practices that could potentially extend lifespan.
Hasn't he been on the Huberman podcast?
I think he has, actually.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he has, yeah.
Yeah, I am too. It's funny how often I absorb somebody's podcast, but actually can't place the actual name of it. I just go to my favorites in my Spotify and play the next episode up. The importance of third-party certification, obviously this is, you know, at the top of our list of things to talk about because it is so probably important and crucial. Why is third-party certification crucial in APAC and how does it affect brand trust and market acceptance?
Yeah. So if you think about it, you know, in today's dietary supplement industry, a minority group of brands actually have third-party certifications. But I really believe that this is going to change drastically in the future. The reason for this is, you know, when you're exploring international markets or you're exploring markets in your domestic region that you might not have thought of before, you can't really rely on maybe your domestic reputation to sell your products and say, oh, my products are high quality because, you know, we're a 40-year-old brand and you should just trust us that we're GMP compliant or for, you know, testing for purity and other issues like that in supplements. And so I think third-party certifications, just to give you some examples, one would be a U.S. Pharmacopeia verified. So that's USP verified. You often see that in Costco. A lot of Kirkland products are USP certified. There's NSF Sport, which is mainly for professional athletes. But a lot of people look at that as a very, very high-end third-party certification, knowing that there's no contamination in the products because athletes have to be tested for doping and other measures like that. And also, what you look at what's happening here in the U.S. market, for example, and in Canada on Amazon, there's lots of new brands selling products, claiming a certain potency in their products. What we've been doing as an industry and some of my colleagues certifiers that I'm working with, they have actually gone out and randomly purchased products off Amazon and had them third-party tested And most of these products, some of these smaller brands are not meeting claim potency, probably because of poor ingredients in the supply chain. And so when you take a step back and you think, if I'm going to sell my products, I'm a dietary supplement brand, I want to sell my products to Indonesia or Japan or South Korea, first of all, you're going to have to meet the regulatory compliance of those countries. But secondly, how are you going to show consumers that your product is organic or is non-GMO, which there are also third-party certifications for? And so I just believe that as this industry gets larger and we approach becoming, you know, a $200, $300 billion industry, third-party certifications are really the only way to discriminate between quality and potentially not very high-quality products.
Let's talk a little bit about developments in supply chain. So I'm going to ask you maybe to talk a little bit about the latest in supply chain innovations in the industry and why it's so important for market access and winning over consumers.
Yeah, so at the top of the show, I did mention that the dietary supplement industry is a global industry. We have a global supply chain. Lots of ingredient suppliers are based in China. A lot of them are in India. If you think of like turmeric or curcumin, a lot of that is from India. And the problem right now is it's a supply chain that is not very compliant with what I'm familiar with here in the U.S., which is the Food Safety Modernization Act with the GMP standards that are needed to comply with U.S. law. So what we are looking to do as a industry alliance, we're currently building a consortium of companies, laboratories, contract manufacturers, and recognized third-party certifiers to really begin to formalize the supply chain. So that's including the entire chain of custody. Who was the original manufacturer of the ingredients? Who has had or handled the ingredients, stored them at their facilities? Because all of this data needs to be tracked in order to really create, at the end of the day, high-quality finished products. And so one interesting facet of this is, as WPIC well knows, for the export of finished products, a lot of these finished products are exported to free trade zones in China or other markets where they're in bond and held at a secure facility where they have not yet entered the national market, basically. They're just in this bonded zone. We here in the U.S. also have what are called foreign trade zones, a little bit different from free trade zones, but it's essentially the same thing where it's a much more formalized and rigorous way to bring in foreign inputs for manufacturing or producing products that end up getting re-exported. There's duty benefits for companies that take this approach. And the most important thing, though, is really just going back to this chain of custody where we know all the participants in the supply chain. We've vetted the suppliers, tested the ingredients, and we have secure framework for really importing and exporting these products, because these products at the end of the day are edible and they have to be temperature controlled. And you have to know, you know, who is really handling the ingredients and the products. So, and lastly, I'll just leave with this thought is, I think it's not only in the dietary supplement industry, but it's other industries as well. Consumers are demanding to know where ingredients are from or where products are from or where they're produced. So really beginning to show consumers how this supply chain is functioning is an important piece of this, because a lot of these ingredients are a part of national traditions of herbal medicine. And to give credit to those countries for practicing herbal medicine, and you know, then the modern industry really learns a lot from those practices and then uses scientific methods to really develop those ingredients to a higher standard or better absorption in the body. So supply chain really, at the end of the day, at least from my vantage point, is a huge part of growing the global dietary supplement industry. And just lastly, one last note, is there is what is called the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. This is somewhat related to APAC and these countries. And it's all about instituting new frameworks for trade and supply chain resilience. So the U.S. Commerce Department recently just opened a new supply chain center. The supply chain agreement is the only part of this Indo-Pacific economic framework that has actually been agreed upon. So there is a lot of push to really begin to build kind of next protocols for supply chains. And I'm quite excited about that.
The next question kind of comes in three parts. We want to talk about functional supplements. So if I could first ask you to describe, what does it mean to be a functional supplement? Why are we seeing increased popularity in functional supplements? And why are they resonating so strongly with busy professionals and the elderly specific?
So functional supplements, first of all, are products with targeted health benefits. For example, supplements could be formulated to boost immunity with vitamin C, zinc, or support gut health with probiotics, prebiotics. But this also really then goes back to the supply chain issue I was just talking about. It's all about specific ingredients. And there are now what are called formatted or branded ingredients where they've actually done clinical studies on some of these ingredients and then also partnered with third-party certifiers to certify the potency and effectiveness and absorption of these ingredients. So it's essentially just taking and upgrading what is currently in the market and making it much more transparent in terms of the scientific research and data behind supplements. And to go to some of your other questions about why functional supplements are increasingly popular, I really think it has to do with intense work hours. I know that's true here in North America where we are, but I think maybe even more so in Asia. So when you think about it, if you're at a high demanding job, say in China, and you're doing Jojo Liu, which is like 996, you're working 9 a.m. to 9 p.m., 6 days a week. I mean, you've got to be supporting your body to be able to take those types of hours, which I don't even understand how people can possibly do that and stay productive the entire time. So for example, you know, cognitive support, you could take magnesium at night. It's both good for your nervous system and maintaining the density and stability of your synapses in your brain. There's 5-HTP, which is an amino acid, and it converts into serotonin in your body. It can make you kind of have a more positive mood during the day. Mushrooms are a huge new product category. And there's actually a great mushroom company that's also a member of a UMPA called Real Mushrooms based out of Canada that are really leaders. So lion's mane for cognitive support, reishi mushrooms for anti-aging or healthy aging. There's also choline just for general brain support. And then also, you know, if you look at anxiety, stress issues, things like that, there's also a lot of good supplements for that. L-theanine, which is an amino acid found in tea and mushrooms. It can help you relax. You can take it with your coffee even to kind of take the edge off the caffeine if caffeine bothers you or you're sensitive to that. And then here in North America, and I also believe in APAC markets, hydration is a huge new industry category. So getting electrolytes early in the morning, water quality obviously is a huge part of that because a lot of these products are a powder that you mix with water. So, you know, there's a ton of things that go into this. And lastly, I'll say performance shots, just different delivery methods. I think the dietary supplement industry is slowly moving away from capsules, tablets, and beginning to move more to kind of functional foods. So that would be like a little, you know, performance shot that's already pre-mixed and you drink it. It's easier for people to take that have problems swallowing pills. And you know, just lastly, anti-aging, bone health, joint support. There's all sorts of products. So I think functional supplements, as well as the third-party certifications, that really is the future of the industry.
You know, when we're talking about mushrooms, we're talking about things like the mud water and things like this. We're not talking about magic mushrooms. We're not talking about psilocybin. And advances in that, which, you know, could come later. I mean, I think if Tim Ferriss
in
or Huberman or those have any say in it, but okay. So just to cover that off. Okay, great. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about e-commerce and digital sales. I want to talk about the significance of the role of e-commerce and digital sales plays in the channels, sales channels in APAC. And then maybe also talk about what strategies should US brands consider for effective market penetration.
As everybody knows, e-commerce is growing worldwide. That got a huge boost from the pandemic. A lot of the traditional sales channels are kind of bleeding off to some degree, particularly some of the direct sale companies, I think are pivoting and changing that more traditional direct-to-consumer marketing pathway. And so when you think about e-commerce sales channels in some of these APAC countries, I'm personally quite familiar with the e-commerce platforms in China. And I think a lot of them are very well regulated, actually, particularly for cross-border e-commerce, which goes through that free trade zone model that I described earlier. But I think one thing to consider is that, you know, if you're going to enter some of these markets, you really do need a partner, a local partner, an international partner. If you're a big enough company and you have compliance personnel that can really go and look at all of these platforms and how to import products into them and be in total compliance with both their customs and you know, FDA equivalent in the country, it's really smart to think about, you know, partnering up with an e-commerce player. And this is part of the reason why we are working with WPIC, is that I think a lot of companies get lost. Just it's very complicated, lots of different markets, lots of different requirements. So you have to be able to partner with an e-commerce player that knows the e-commerce platforms, which ones are reputable, which ones aren't going to, you know, make your brand devalued in some sense by being on kind of a lower tier market. And I think as well, you can also engage with your local U.S. commercial service office. So this is within the International Trade Administration. They have offices in all 50 states. They're posted throughout the embassies worldwide. And you can work with them to ask about local partners. For example, if you're at a trade show, you meet somebody and it's a partner, say, from Indonesia, it's always a good idea to potentially get an international company profile done on local partners, so you know who you're working with. But I think at the end of the day, really working with an established e-commerce accelerator or trade partner is the way to go for most companies.
I want to key in on some key markets like Japan and South Korea. So how do the market characteristics of Japan and South Korea differ when it comes to dietary supplements, especially considering Japan's regulatory environment and South Korea's integration with the K-beauty industry?
So I'll start off with Japan, because this, of course, also goes back to the supply chain issues. And, you know, if there's not high quality ingredients, then the finished products could have quite serious consequences, health consequences even, adverse events, things of that nature. So earlier this year, there was a Japanese pharmaceutical company that had a red yeast rice product that was contaminated with mold, because it is a fermented product. But this ended in several fatalities in Japan and created a huge controversy regarding the oversight of dietary supplements in Japan. So now the Japanese government has really stood up and looked at this issue, and they are now requiring companies essentially to meet the same requirements that pharmaceuticals do in terms of their manufacturing processes. So that includes mandatory adverse events reporting. It requires good manufacturing practices, be able to prove that you've actually it complied or been audited by a third party, and also guaranteeing the quality of raw material. So Japan right now is in a little bit of a flux. It's traditionally a very well regulated industry, but, you know, something like the red yeast issue with those products could happen really anywhere. And so at the end of the day, Japan is still growing. It's not growing at huge leaps and bounds, but it's still a growing market, 2-5% per year. I think South Korea, in many ways, because their regulatory environment is also shifting from a more kind of OTC registered system to now what are called health functional foods, which can be distributed through supermarkets and e-commerce platforms. And I think because of South Korea's cultural presence in today's world with K-pop and everything else, there is a big opportunity, I think, in South Korea for beauty products, collagen, lysine, both which are important for skin health, zinc, things of that nature. So I still believe that these markets are like we mentioned earlier, they're complicated, have different compliance requirements, and the consumers are also really kind of looking at different aspects of the industry.
Yeah, you're definitely right there. Now, outside of those markets, we also have emerging markets in Southeast Asia. Can you talk about some of the opportunities that are emerging in Southeast Asian countries like Vietnam, Thailand, and Indonesia for dietary supplements?
So first of all, you know, if you think of Southeast Asia, I don't think people appreciate, you know, the population in some of these countries. Indonesia has 275 million people. The U.S. is like 330 million people. So it's a little bit smaller than the U.S. in terms of population. Huge market, probably underappreciated, but a lot of companies are now looking at pediatric multivitamins to support children's growth, as they've had some issues with stunting and other things, with malnutrition, folic acid for pregnancy, because these are still markets that have population growth, very different from South Korea, Japan, some of the more mature markets. And I would also just talk a little bit about India as an emerging market. I know India is not in Southeast Asia, that exact category, but India right now is trying to become kind of the next big natural health product industry. They have this government target to become a $100 billion market in the next 10 to 20 years. I went to India last year to attend kind of the kickoff conference for this government initiative. And I think this will be mirrored in other markets like, you know, Vietnam, Thailand, where they're really going to have more government support, because if people can act in a kind of more preventative health care environment, or, you know, be able to live in that type of environment and not just retroactively treating health conditions, it also saves governments a lot of money. So I think Southeast Asia is very interesting. I am not an expert on Southeast Asia, but I do really, truly believe it is a booming market.
Absolutely. And you're right. Some of the population sizes over there would catch you by surprise. If you're just looking at a map and trying to say, well, the size geographically would indicate that it was probably at this population, you would be dead wrong, because you look at the size of Indonesia and then you look at the amount of people that live there. It is a very dense place. And a lot of countries in Southeast Asia are like that. Lastly, I want to talk about challenges in the regulatory landscapes. So maybe to ask you if you can elaborate on the diverse regulatory requirements across APAC and how should new entrants navigate them?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if we summarize this conversation, this is probably the key topic for brand holders that are looking to enter foreign markets in APAC is, you know, how do you do this when each country has different regulatory requirements? Probably not all information is published in English about these regulatory requirements. So it's very difficult even for me to get a grasp of all the various requirements across APAC. But I do think, you know, if you look at the way in which global trade is now developing, I'll give China as an example. So China, back in 2022, the General Administration for China Customs, they announced what is called Decree 248 for imported food producers. So this requires companies, whether it's in Canada, the US, other markets, to go on to a China customs portal called the National Single Window. Every country actually has one of these national single windows. And you have to disclose information about your product, about the production of it, so that there's more assurance that these products that are coming into, say, China or Japan or South Korea, they're already in compliance with their competent authorities. So the competent authorities, say, in the US would be the FDA. And how to verify that is going to become more and more serious, because if we look at the Japan case of the red yeast product, think if a product like that was exported, say there was an issue with a product, is contaminated, exported from the US to whatever APAC market, and then there's a serious adverse event with fatalities in the market. I guarantee you that will shut down cross-border e-commerce for dietary supplements for some period of time, at least in that specific country. So I think more and more these national single windows, these customs portals, like I mentioned, each country has one, are going to become more and more important to verify, for example, your third-party certifications and to track for anti-counterfeiting purposes, for traceability purposes. And this is really the key for companies to become successful in markets is then, you know, getting your products up to compliance in your domestic market, say in the US market, in compliance with GMP regulations here, and then working with, say, e-commerce accelerator like WPIC, who has people on the ground or even warehouses on the ground in some of these free trade zones in APAC countries to import your products in full compliance with national regulations. And so I think the work that e-commerce accelerators like WPIC do are critical to this whole ecosystem. WPIC might not be on the supply chain side, but they're on the finished product side, and they are part of the chain of custody, because if companies are exporting from the US and they export to WPIC's Nanjing warehouse, WPIC is taking possession of that product in their warehouse. They're within the chain of custody. So you have to verify if they're holding those products at a right temperature, or if it's a temperature controlled product like a probiotic, do they have refrigeration for those products? And I think this is something that a lot of smaller, say, small and medium sized enterprises really miss sometimes, is that a local partner you meet at a trade show and they'll tell you, oh, I'll open the market for you. I have all the government relationships and don't worry, we'll have great success together. I believe that that can be possible in some ways, but I think the growing compliance requirements for all of these countries is kind of making that model quite outdated, where you now need to work with a much larger group that has a compliance staff who are very familiar with the regulations in all these various APAC countries. So that's why UMPA has partnered now with WPIC to work on this program in also partnership with the U.S. Commercial Service. So just wanted to thank WPIC for their work in helping us to secure and trace the finished products that are being exported to foreign markets.
Daniel Mabee, thank you very much for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Todd.
If you have a guest recommendation, please feel free to hit us up by email, podcast@wpic.co. We would love to hear who you would like to see or hear on the show. Please, if you can, give us a 5-star rating. It really, really helps us out and feeds those algorithms that are so important in getting our content to new listeners out there. If you are listening audio only, don't forget that we have all the stuff on YouTube, the shorts, the full videos over at the WPIC YouTube channel. If you're watching the video and you want to go audio only, we are available on all your favorite podcast platforms. And for me and for Daniel and for everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching. We'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so.
The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.